face to face with death, irrespective of whether the subject of the image is still alive when we contemplate his or her portrait. But awareness of transience doesn't simply give human experience its ambivalent and bittersweet quality as we try to hold on to the moment that we cannot suspend in its flight towards oblivion. It's fundamentally constitutive of that experience. In Rilke's terms, in English though, not in German, we live our lives forever taking leave. Human subjectivity does not pre-exist its relationship to the other. Identity and alterity are mutually self-creating. Indeed, one of the constants of 20th century French thought is precisely its sensitivity to the inescapable imbrication of self and other, subject and object, love and loss. It's our awareness of mortality that creates the lack or the fissure in the self through which subjectivity is born. It ultimately prevents the closure that would ossify the subject and allow the rigid ego to take hold. In existential terms, I'm going to just run through four different examples of how this works. In existential terms, we desire the impossible combination of liberty and identity, to know and be indeed who we are while still remaining fully free. In psychoanalytic terms, we seek narcissistic closure, that's to say, self-sufficiency and self-identity, but such closure would entail the death of the subject. Paradoxically, perhaps, the subject remains alive and mobile only because of its relation to mortality, both its own and that of others. It's love that makes us fear death, love of the self and love of the other. We fear losing our very selves when we risk losing what we love. And I would say it's our anguish in the face of loss and death that lies at the heart of our uncertainty about the ontological significance of the body. If I am my body, I die when my body dies. But this prospect of ineradicable loss, whether it's of self or other, is precisely what's most inimical, since it puts my very identity at stake. Consequently, I'm tempted to differentiate myself from my body in a form of what I'd call natural dualism. But this dualism too founders on the reefs of experience and imagination. If I or the beloved am not to be identified with the body, what does that mean for the powerful physical affection and desire that accompanies and arguably constitutes human love? But despite their intimate imbrication, mortality and subjectivity are not often analyzed in conjunction with each other. Modern philosophy has produced a vast range of theories of subjectivity, from the Cartesian cogito, through Kant's unity of apperception, Searle's transcendental ego, Sartre's non-self-identical subject, to the fragmented and decentered subject of post-structuralism and deconstruction. But what's generally explored in the theorization of subjectivity is its genesis, its constitution, its essence or lack of essence, its identity, and its relation to otherness, not its disintegration, its weakness, and its ultimate dissolution in the radical alterity of death. Critiques of the subject tend to assume its coherence, independence, and voluntarism. They set up the subject, in my view, as a kind of straw man whose overweening pretensions to unity and autonomy are all the easier to demolish. They rarely allow for conceptions of subjectivity, which already manifest the vulnerability and fragility which they claim characterize the subject as it should be understood. But the link between subjectivity and mortality lies at the heart of this paper, my paper this evening. What happens to the subject in death? What does the embodiment of subjectivity mean for the subject at the point of death? And how do these fundamental questions relate to the so-called death of the subject, as it was understood in the second half of the 20th century? When we reflect on human mortality, we're usually light years away from the death of the subject, where death is used as a metaphor. Indeed, on this occasion, one might say a mere metaphor, to refer to a complex epistemological change in which one conception is gradually, or maybe even suddenly, replaced by another. We've not been able, really, of course, to think the death of the subject, or the death of man, or even the death of God. The subject, man, and God are still with us in diverse guises. And the phrases themselves, the death of man, the death of God, imply on some level, I think, an aggression. The death of God or the subject is not something we're encouraged to mourn, though some may. It's rather held up as a kind of challenge, a challenge to us to assist in the declared demise, or maybe even to celebrate it. But mortality itself is a different matter. The term has not, I think, yet been hijacked by an anti-humanist lobby. It's not usually associated with a concept. The death of man, Foucault's death of man, if you like, and the mortality of man have a very different sense. The former describes the end of an outmoded notion, the latter, an inevitable and inescapable part of the human condition. So, what does death mean for our understanding of the subject? Now, I wasn't going, and I'm not going, and there's even less reason to, enter into the debates about the merits and demerits of the Heideggerian notion, which we heard about so beautifully earlier on, of being for death, being towards death, and its opposition by Sartre, amongst others. But nor do I wish to remain on the level of bodily mortality, that undeniable disintegration of our physical selves. My purpose here is somewhat different. I want to reflect on the implications of human mortality for our understanding of the human subject, and perhaps to try to begin thinking about the implications of our understanding of mortality for contemporary meditations on the fragility of the subject. Fragility, I think, seems to be one of the links between the two kinds of death, fragility and vulnerability. Because if the self-contained and self-sufficient subject of classical humanism never in fact existed, even as a concept, it's still true that our contemporary understanding of the human subject stresses fragmentation over totalization, decentering over centeredness, difference over identity, absence over presence. All the classical markers, if you think about it, of death over life. Absence, fragmentation. Nonetheless, that's not what's meant by the death of the subject. We don't mean, when we talk about the death of the subject, the replacement of a subject characterized by vitality and growth, by a subject marked by the downward path of disintegration and weakness. Weak thought may have entered our conceptual apparatus as an alternative to the thought of the so-called master thinkers, but the weak subject still tends to sound close to a form of oxymoron. So we rarely, if ever, bring together the two meanings of the death of the subject. Our meditations on subjectivity remain at a level of philosophical abstraction that necessarily excludes individual personal death. Our reflections on mortality, use the terminology of selfhood, individuality, the body, rather than that of subjectivity. In a sense, we might be said to continue unwittingly a form of mind-body dualism, albeit with a different vocabulary that masks the divide more effectively. It's human embodiment that makes us mortal and makes us passionate. In turn, our mortality deepens our passion because it ensures the ultimate loss and destruction of all we love. Passion and death are intimately involved in subjectivity. It's our mortality that makes us free subjects, able to love, to give, and, of course, to die for others. We are mortal because we live in time, not eternity. And this constitutes also our singularity as subjects. Subject to time, subject to death, and subject to passion. Now, one of the most constant and, I would say, symptomatic elements in recent philosophical discussions of death is their recourse to paradox and aporia. I called my paper, I think, Yes, Mortality, Qui Per Gagne. And I believe that this maxim of Qui Per Gagne, loser wins, is one of the most significant elements in helping us to understand some of the problems that face us when we're trying to disentangle this very complex question of human death and mortality. Now, I just say, perhaps it's obvious, but I just say that Qui Per Gagne is not meant here in the trivial sense of some kind of fatal reversal or comeuppance, but rather in the more profound sense of a salvation that comes through failure. Now, the religious version of this paradox has been a constant and said to be scandalous theme in Christian theology and soteriology. Soteriology, in case you don't know, it's the theology of salvation. As the Beatitudes maintain, grief and mourning are unavoidable prerequisites for redemption. And the folly of Christ's passion and death on the cross is the highest form of wisdom, which goes far beyond the limitations of human rationality and self-interest. So it shouldn't surprise us then if religious philosophers like Yankelevich, and Taylor's just bought Yankelevich's book on death, if religious philosophers are thinkers of paradox and reversal. But what of the others? Well, existentialists too. And the Qui Per Gagne paradox, most commonly associated with Sartre, certainly are philosophers of paradox, most markedly where subjectivity is concerned. It's precisely our failure to achieve self-identity that allows us to be free. It's our non-self coincidence, our pour soi, which is not soi, it is pour soi, riven by self-division, never soi. Our diasporic, that word is in Lettres de Néant, and whether absurd is or not, our diasporic subjectivity provides the key to our ability to change and to choose to be who we want to be. Religion, existentialism, psychoanalysis too. Paradox is a privileged structure of understanding. The death drive is essential to life. The pleasure principle protects us from an excess of jouissance. The psychoanalytic subject is riven whether it's Freud or Lacan, whether born from the Freudian Spaltung, that's the splitting within the ego or between consciousness and unconscious, or whether you see it from in the Lacanian emergence out of the imaginary into the symbolic order. It's our inability to achieve completion that always defines us as human. You see it in deconstruction too. Deconstruction with its strong version of a paradoxical logic, logique paradoxale, in which difference ensures that the self-presence we may yearn for is forever impossible. and stasis is avoided in areas as diverse as signification, subjectivity, ethics, and politics. The Kiper-Gagne structure also operates deconstructively in areas such as mourning, where Derrida argues that successful mourning fails to protect the alterity of the other, whereas a failed internalization shows respect for the other as other. Though I must just alert you to the fact that Derrida isn't accepting this aporetic schema as doing any more than demonstrate the impossibility of what would be true mourning. Fails in one direction or it fails in the other. So what are the implications of this paradoxical mode of thought for the relationship between subjectivity and mortality? It can perhaps be best expressed in the post-Kantian structure, popularized by but not exclusive to Derrida, which has come to be termed the possible-impossible aporia, X as a condition of both possibility and impossibility of Y. Derrida employs this structure to explore notions such as hospitality, the gift, forgiveness, or in this case, mourning, where internalization of the other could be described as its condition of both possibility and impossibility. I shall use this aporetic structure to express the relationship between subjectivity and mortality. Mortality, I would suggest, is the condition of possibility and the condition of impossibility of subjectivity. Now, this may initially sound Heideggerian, but it's not. Whereas for Heidegger, you must correct me if I'm wrong, but it's what I think. Whereas for Heidegger, death was described as the ownmost possibility of Dasein, and indeed as the possibility of the absolute impossibility of Dasein. This is not the notion to which I'm referring, though of course it is related to it. Heidegger, I thinks in terms of being towards death as constitutive of Dasein's most fundamental being, but it's the notion that Sartre in particular rejects. For Sartre, death is not my possibility, it's rather, and I'm quoting, an always possible annihilation of my possibles. So what does it mean to describe mortality as the condition of possibility and of impossibility of subjectivity? The specific relationship between subjectivity and mortality needs further thought. Human mortality and finitude are arguably what makes the subject, in its traditional sense of self-sufficient, autonomous, spontaneous foundation of knowledge, understanding, feeling, and imagination, an impossible ideal. And one nowadays, of course, generally considered philosophically outmoded and illusory. If the death of man is no longer center stage in contemporary French philosophy, this is not, I think, because of some kind of resurrection. It's rather because the considerable philosophical work that went into dismantling the humanist conception of the subject has worked, if you like. It's been both assimilated and refined. The jubilation with which the subject, so-called death, was celebrated may have been crude and suspiciously over-emphatic, but it's best seen, I would argue, as a reversal phase in any reinterpretation of subjectivity. Mortality and finitude, then, bring us face to face with our fragility as subjects, and the loss of faith and its accompanying hope for life beyond death means that we cannot continue either to wager on eternal life as saving our souls while our bodies die and decay. Mortality is the condition of impossibility of subjectivity, at least in any version of it, which involves sovereign mastery or transcendence of the body. The very notion, using a famous phrase, that I might shuffle off my mortal coil, has come to seem incoherent. Who am I to shuffle off the very bodily existence that constitutes me? But this is not because the soul does not exist, not for these philosophers that I've been thinking about anyway. On the contrary, and surprisingly perhaps, it's because it does. Kristeva and Nancy envisage the soul, they talk about the soul, as the place where the mind-body dualism might perhaps be overcome. For Lacan too, aimé d'amour, with a circumflex over the A to show that it's referring to the soul, aimé d'amour, is what enables us to put up with what would be otherwise intolerable. But it's also my mortality and finitude that constitute my subjectivity in the sense that the terms used by the modern philosophers that I'm thinking about today. Mortality is the condition of possibility of subjectivity in the modern sense. It's because I'm not self-sufficient or self-identical or immortal that my subjectivity comes into being in its self-division and diaspora, to use Sartre's terminology, or in its difference, to use Derrida's. Sartre may not accept Heidegger's conception of Dasein as being towards death, but he describes the forward-looking anticipatory nature of the pourvoir as structurally constitutive of our subjectivity or ipseity. Derrida, even more clearly than Sartre, links selfhood to death, arguing in one of his essays on Paul de Man that we are never ourselves, that's the quote, and that the reflexive specularity which creates the self is never closed and is brought into being by the possibility of mourning. So that our lack of self-identity coexists precisely with our openness to the presence of the other within me, not only after his actual death, but during his life. There's no friendship, Derrida writes, without this knowledge of finitude. Jean-Luc Nancy, too, describes our mortality as what creates our subjectivity, leaving us wounded, open to the heart of the other within me. And I'm thinking, of course, amongst other things, of L'Intrus, Nancy's essay on his heart transplant. Yankelevich, too, Yankelevich's reflections on transience similarly attribute the possibility of joy, which makes us truly human, to the death that awaits us. Subjectivity and mortality are then linked in an aporetic structure in which subjectivity is simultaneously created and abolished by mortality, made possible at the same time as made impossible. That mortality brings all subjects to an end, at least for themselves, of course needs no demonstration. Though many of the philosophers that I've been working on envisage some kind of continuity for our et pour autrui in the hearts and minds of others, including Sartre. That mortality undermines and makes insecure and fragile the grounded autonomous subject is, I think, what links death in the true sense, what Lacan would call the real with the capital R, the domain of inassimilable trauma, to the metaphorical and much abused notion of the death of the subject. The unattainability of sovereign mastery conditions and creates our subjectivity precisely as it makes it impossible. This possible, impossible aporetic structure is not restricted to the existential Heideggerian thematic of Dasein. It rather takes the question of the relationship between subjectivity and mortality further, beyond the pathos of finitude, to the more strictly philosophical level of what Sartre calls the circuit d'ipséité, the circuit of selfness. Well, reflection on death is not, of course, the monopoly of philosophy. And I'd like to speak for a moment a little bit about things that are not philosophy pure: photography, sculpture. I don't know if you know a text by Derrida, Demeure Athènes. In this text, Derrida offers a series of meditations on Greek landscapes, people, statues, and photographs taken by a wonderful photographer, Jean-François Bonhomme. And like Barthes before him, Derrida is drawn to reflect on the paradoxical nature of the photograph, capturing a moment which is always already past and can never be retrieved. So whatever its subject or purpose, Derrida argues, no photograph can avoid signifying death. And the images of ancient Greek statuary and contemporary village life, though very different, provide an especially acute reminder of mortality in their juxtaposition of recent and distant past. Are the street vendors of a few years ago any closer or more alive than the ruins of ancient Athens? Each photograph, he writes, in any case, recalls death fulfilled, the promise or threat of death, sepulchral monuments, and memory in the form of ruin. Like Sarah Kaufman, Taylor earlier on was talking about Sartre and his awareness of failure and the way in which failure seems to permeate. I don't think it's just Sartre at all. I think it's basically everybody who has ever thought about anything. This is all we can see, failure all around us. Derrida's vividly aware that, but as I say, it's a qui per gagne. If it wasn't for failure, where would we be? We'd be stuck. We'd be stuck. It would be terrible. Derrida's vividly aware that the power of art comes in part from its multiple failures. Its failure to represent, its failure to express, its failure to transcend, and its failure to retain or possess time passing. The closer art comes to life, as in photographs of people, the more poignant the inevitable difference becomes. I think there's something in the instantaneity of the photograph that points up the paradox particularly acutely. And this is a very vivid example, I would say, of qui per gagne. But it's the message of all art, not just photography, the message indeed of all cultural products, intellectual and spiritual, as well as aesthetic. Now, when I wrote my book on mortal subjects, I put in some poems into my last chapter because I thought that the poems somehow made more vivid than the philosophers what I was trying to get across. And I'm not going to certainly read them now, but the one poem was by Yeats, another was by Shelley. Shelley's poem Ozymandias. In that poem, which I expect a lot of you know, the eventual fate of our passions, like that of our works, can only ever be wreckage, decay, and oblivion. Confronted with the ravages of time, our lips, hands, hearts, and selves give way to what Shelley calls the lone and level sands. And like the series of tombs described by Derrida, the monument itself expresses mourning, not simply in its purpose, monument to Ozymandias, and it's eroded, but also in its very structure. It mourns through its discrete, this is Derrida, it mourns through its discrete structure, interruption, separation, repetition, living on, that's survivance in French. It mourns for itself, beyond the trappings of death that provide its theme. There's a problem, though, I think, with literature. There's a problem. Are we saying, I'm very Sartrean here, are we saying that there are things that can only be said by literature and can't be said by philosophy? I mean, maybe we are. It's something that Sartre did not like the idea of. Often philosophers themselves turn to literature when they want to evoke particularly powerfully. So I think of Kristeva in Histoire d'amour, or Yankelevich on death and indeed love, and indeed Narcy, when he talks about love, sex, heart transplants, it's very poetic. The problem with this is, are we saying then that there are things that philosophy can't say? Are we saying that there are things that literature can say? I think that this is, well, maybe I shouldn't be worrying about it, because it's, once again, it's through failure that literature communicates so successfully. It's because it's not precise. I've got a little quote from Sartre here, and surprisingly, it's actually from Qu'est-ce que la littérature? Now, Qu'est-ce que la littérature? People always think of that text of Sartre as being such a polemical and unsubtle text. It's not true at all. This is what Sartre says at one point in Qu'est-ce que la littérature? I'm afraid it's in English. If it's true that speech is a betrayal and communication is impossible, then each word conceals its individuality and becomes an instrument of our defeat and harborer of the incommunicable. It's not that there's something else to communicate, but prose communication having failed, it's the very meaning of the word that becomes the pure incommunicable. Failure, then, may be ineradicable. It may be useful. It's sometimes put to good use. You remember in Saint Genet, the last chapter of Sartre's work on Genet, he calls Prière pour le bon usage de Jean Genet. And the bon usage of Genet is using Genet against his best intentions. Genet wants to do one thing. Sartre says he's going to do something quite different with him. He's going to use Genet as a moral example. Right, so nonetheless, Sartre is suspicious of the incommunicable. He thinks that it can be hijacked by extremists. I mistrust the incommunicable, he says. It's the source of all violence. That's, I think, why literature can supplement philosophy, but not supplant it. Now, okay, I'm going to miss something out here in order to just say a couple of words about Michel Serres. So summing up what I've just been saying, for people who have only been half following it because they're French, and my English, I've tried to be clear, but it's never as easy as if you're reading it, is it? I think 20th century French philosophy is acutely aware that mortality and subjectivity are inseparable, that identity is fragile and even fictional, and that its imbrication with alterity is what keeps us from peaceful self-coincidence at the same time as constituting us as subjects. There are no easy answers to these questions. I think there are maybe no answers at all. What I wanted to say about Michel Serres was that, you know, when I was invited to speak at this conference, I thought maybe I should do my paper on Michel Serres, but I decided not to because I thought that it was a broad topic and a broad paper would be better. But there's an awful lot in Michel Serres that takes us far beyond what I've been talking about. I've been about self and other. The whole paper, whether it was psychoanalysis, existentialism, deconstruction, all about self and other. Michel Serres goes so far beyond this. I'm going to give you a couple of quotes from Michel Serres just to whet your appetites. Okay, this is from Homines's eulogy at the beginning. We no doubt became the humans we are by having learnt that we were going to die. By destroying our lives, death constructs them. Without the stiff cadaver it leaves behind, without the sex it was long believed to imply, Would we ever have painted the walls of caves, lit fires, and so on? Loved our companions, educated children. The question, am I going towards death or am I delivering myself from it, constructs meaning. Then, this is really grist to the mill that I was talking about. He's talking about human beings, but then he extends the range of mortality far beyond the human individual. He proposes four deaths. The death of ourselves and those we love. Now that's death one, that's the whole of my paper. Secondly, the death of entire cultures. Talks about Greek culture, Egyptian culture, Roman culture, that's much bigger. The other two deaths, I think, are less predictable. On the macro scale, he contemplates the global death of humanity, wiped out by some chance, some natural event, meteors, volcanoes, global warming, or perhaps man's inhumanity to man in nuclear disaster, prefigured already by Hiroshima. That's the global death of humanity. Well, what of the fourth death? I'm very sorry that Kathleen Malibu isn't here, because I thought I was going to talk to Kathleen Malibu about this question. Anyway, as to use one of Sayre's phrases, I wasn't expecting that. Depends how much you've read of Sayre, but he often says this. He says it a lot in The Parasite. I wasn't expecting that. What of this fourth death? I wasn't expecting that. Here we go from the macro to the micro scale, to the intimate death of the cell in apoptosis, which Sayre tells us was the name the Greeks gave to the fall of leaves in autumn. Now, isn't that lovely? It's now used for cancer, but anyway, the fall of leaves in autumn. It's very splendid. Apoptosis, in the modern sense, is the death of the cell, C-E-L-L. But like the other paradoxes that I've been exploring, it's also the key to life. It's apoptosis that fails when cancerous cells proliferate. In cancer, the organism dies from too much life. Apoptosis, the death of the cell, fails, and then cancer takes over. Apoptosis kills us at the same time as it invents our life. Here we are. I'm giving Sayre the last word. It's hominescence. Sung by the arts, mediated by religions and philosophies, the two traditional deaths strike individual bodies and local groups. The two new deaths frame the first ones, symmetrically, the one in globality, human race, living species, entire planet, the other in the minuteness of the elementary cell and the tiny signals that constitute it. Once again, we can't think life, and humans in particular, without death, nor can we think the absurdity of the latter, that's death, without giving meaning to the former. The energy governing the formation of the one goes hand in glove with the other. The couple works to bring about time. Thanks to oxygen, I breathe, and its rust destroys me. What kills me comforts me. All right, thank you.